This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Welcome to Desert Island Discs, where every week I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, the book and the luxury item that they'd want to take with them if they were cast away on a desert island. For rights reasons, the music on these podcast versions is shorter than in the original broadcast. You can find over 2,000 more editions to listen to and download on the Desert Island Discs website. My castaway this week is the midwife and campaigner Edna Adan Ismail. As a child growing up in what was then British Somaliland in the 1940s, her dream was to build her own hospital. By the mid-50s, she'd won a scholarship to study in Britain, but life, as it has a habit of doing, got in the way. It took 50 years and all her savings to finally realise her dream. In 2002, the Edna Adan Maternity and Teaching Hospital emerged from the rubble of a bloody civil war, testament to my castaway's personal mantra: if I don't do it, then who will? It's a dictum she's lived her entire life by. Married at one time to the Prime Minister of Somalia, she juggled the high-profile role of First Lady with nursing shifts, and later, as her country's first ever female foreign minister, broke deep-rooted taboos by publicly condemning the widespread practice of female genital mutilation. A public health scandal, yes, but a highly personal struggle too. Aged just 8, she herself was violently disfigured by FGM. It was her grandmother who had arranged the procedure. She says, "Don't say you have nothing. You have a brain, and that is everything. You should give up saying I cannot do and say I will try to do." And so, welcome, Edna. In the 15 years then since your hospital opened, 20,000 babies have been delivered, is that right?
I think we're close to 22,000 now.
What can you remember? Can you remember the very first birth at your hospital?
Yes, absolutely. The very first one was born about 8 hours after we opened, after the big ceremony of the vice president of the country was there and a lot of dignitaries and a whole lot of women singing and dancing and joyful event. And a few hours later, a woman was brought in labour. That little boy is now 15, 16 years old. And hopefully he will become a doctor one day, because that's what he wants to become.
And were you present at the delivery?
But of course. Why would somebody else have all the joy of delivering my baby and my hospital, the hospital that took my whole life to build?
You were once described in print, I saw, as tough as General Petraeus, as compassionate as the Pope, as tireless as Michael Phelps, as beautiful as Tina Turner, with a work ethic to rival Bill Gates.
Oh my goodness.
What do you make of that description?
I hope it describes a woman who has to put in a whole lot of hours. And in 1991, when we emerged from a civil war where everything was lost, 95% of the city was flattened, no hospitals, no schools, no homes, one doesn't have time to think twice about what needs to be done.
You'd originally opened this, I mean, and it is a bright, shining beacon. To see photographs of it, it looks extraordinary. It looks relatively state-of-the-art, relatively high-tech hospital.
Well, if I'm going to give a gift, it has to be a good gift.
But it was supposed to be just a maternity hospital, and very quickly that was not the way it worked out. What happened?
An 8-year-old man was knocked down by a donkey cart just outside of the hospital, and he was brought in. We need to suture him. We need to stop that bleeding. We need to take care of him and worry about whether he's pregnant or not another time. But we have to stop the bleeding. Why not? It's my decision. It's my hospital.
Is it true you live on site? You live in the hospital?
I cannot afford to live anywhere else. I lived on the site for 8 months before the hospital was opened. But I had no windows. I had no electricity. My water was brought in by a bucket. And the construction crew would come in the morning at 6 o'clock and continue the construction. At night, I was the only ghost floating around there.
And how do you switch off? When do you switch off then? Do you ever?
I'm a midwife. I was trained to wake up in the middle of the night. So staying up, for me, is not an ordeal. It's something I've done all my life.
Let's take a look then at your music, at your Desert Island Discs. Tell me the first one we're going to hear and tell me why you've chosen it.
Happy is a very happy song. And on a particular occasion, I was travelling. I was in transit in Dubai airport, angry with the airlines for having misplaced my luggage, and the connection to Somaliland was delayed. And I just heard this music. It made my burden so much lighter, my knees less aching. Whenever I feel a little bit depressed, I listen to it.
That was Pharrell Williams and Happy. Edna, I should remind listeners then that Somaliland declared independence in 1991. It sits just in the Horn of Africa, a population of around about 4 million. It's bordered by Somalia, with Djibouti to the northwest and Ethiopia is to the south and west. And it is, as you have said, an area that has been riven over decades by civil war, by brutality. Somaliland itself remains internationally unrecognised. I would like you, if you could, just to give us a snapshot, given everything that's happened,
sure,
of how stable a place it is to live currently.
It's stable. It has a government, elected presidents. We have a constitution. We have a law. We have the courts. We have the police force. We have demobilized the militia of Somaliland in 1995, 96.
And you were, of course, the pioneer, the woman who was at the very beginning of these changes in Somaliland. In 1961, you returned to your country as the first ever qualified nurse,
yes,
and midwife.
And proud of it.
Yes.
Trained in Britain.
And what were the challenges you met when you went back?
Well, the challenges I met were before I came to England, because at that time the nursing profession was seen as something that was below the dignity of the daughter of a doctor.
Right.
People would go to my mother and say, "Oh, we heard the bad news. You poor thing. Your daughter has chosen to become a nurse. What will become of her? Who will ever want to marry her?" And I love nursing. I was passionate about it. I love midwifery. So when I went home in 1961, I had to introduce nursing and midwifery to my country and start training midwives. Today, families come to me and say, "We want our daughters to become like you."
And how is your hospital funded? I mean, day to day.
Everything is not free, of course. I have salaries to pay. I have food to provide, medicines and equipment. But then my hospital was built for that poor woman who has nothing, who's bleeding, who's dying, and who has nowhere else to go. These women I treat for free. But other patients who have, somebody says, "I want my wife to have a private room." I say, "Good, good. You can pay $25 a day."
And it is a nomadic culture. How far have people sometimes travelled to the doors of your hospital?
People come to me from wherever they wish to come from. They come from neighbouring Somalia. They come from Ethiopia. They come from Djibouti. They come from all corners of Somaliland. For instance, children with hydrocephaly. We're the only hospital in the Horn of Africa that inserts shunts into the heads of little children.
So this is a complex brain condition.
Yeah, yes. You know, the water in the brain. We've operated on 400 or 500 children. If they were to go elsewhere and go abroad, it would have cost them $15,000. We treat them for free. That's a lot of credit in the bank upstairs.
Tell me about your second piece of music then, Edna Adam. What are we going to hear?
You'll be hearing Mahaydan Tu'ishe Wilo. We used to sing it when we had the communist occupation, and it was a song of resistance.
Abdi Noor Alale and Edna Adan. I'm going to ask you to say the title of the song, because if I say it, I'm going to absolutely mangle it. How do you say that?
Mahaydantu Ishewil. And it's a song that gives you hope. And even though you've had drought and dryness, God will send the rains and you will swim in pools of rainwater. When you were in the dark, the moon will come out just before you step on a snake on the road. So don't give up hope.
And speaking of water, you yourself certainly look as if you've been drinking at the Fountain of Youth, because in my notes here it says you were born in 1937, which I find impossible to believe,
yes,
looking into your face. It was
into just 80.
Well, congratulations for that. It was a relatively privileged environment you were born into. Just tell me a bit about your family circumstances.
Well, my father was a doctor. My father was somebody who was known as the father of healthcare. I was privileged to go to school, went to school in Djibouti. poverty because there were no schools for girls in my country, British Somaliland Protectorate.
And you say your father was this very prominent physician. Did you spend any time with him at his work?
I used to hang around the hospital and give him a hand, and he would say, could you go and wash those forceps for me? And if he had to travel overnight in 2 or 3 days, he'd leave me a little list and say, while I'm away, make sure they do this, release this catheter, make sure they remove the sutures tomorrow. So as the boss's daughter, I would make sure that the instructions were followed, and he was my hero, still is. I will never be as compassionate as he was. I will never be as kind and generous with his time, with his emotions, with his affection. A good man.
What did he teach you about how patients should be treated?
With respect. And there was a particular incident. He was opening, lancing an abscess, and of course, a dirty, elderly, unclean person, and I was holding a bowl under the jaw so that, you know, whatever was coming out should go there. And it must have shown on my face. And when the patient was cleaned and was out of the room, he closed the room and he said, don't you ever dare show such an ugly face to my patients. That old man was even more precious than his firstborn, me, the person who he referred to as the apple of his eye. But the patient came first.
You have said that the idea of building your own hospital began to germinate when you watched your father going about his work as a doctor. So when can you place that? When?
I was about 12 or 11, and I would often hear my father voicing a wish and saying, oh, I wish I had a better forceps than this. I wish I had a pair of scissors that would cut. I wish I had a better hospital. And I just made a mental note that one day I would build the kind of hospital my father would have liked to work in. How I would do it, I didn't know. What I would use to make it happen, I didn't know. But I carried it in my mind and in my heart. And when I retired at age 60, that's when I had the time and I had the opportunity and I had the means and the resources in which to do it.
I asked you about your family there, and you've spoken clearly, so full of love about your father. I haven't mentioned your mother. Tell me about your mum.
Well, my mother was a great woman, a woman who had wished I had been a normal girl, who didn't go out to work, who didn't ride bicycles, who didn't wrestle with boys, who didn't climb trees, someone who would just sit at home and learn to cook and prepare herself to become a good wife. She never gave up on me until she died. She was a few days short of 92. But she still wished I had been a normal girl.
Tell me about your third.
Sorry.
It didn't work out.
It didn't work out.
Tell me about your third piece of music then, Edda. What are we going to hear now?
Oh, Non, je ne regrette rien by Edith Piaf. And I have absolutely no regrets. No regrets being a nurse. No regrets being a midwife. No regrets climbing trees. No regrets ever.
Non, rien de rien. Ni le bien qu'on m'a fait, ni le mal, tout ça m'est bien égal. Non, rien de rien. Non, je ne regrette rien.
Non, je ne regrette rien. That was Edith Piaf. So, Edna Adan, female genital mutilation, FGM, it is a very difficult and distressing subject for people to approach. And it is one, FGM continues to be deeply culturally ingrained in your homeland. Why is that?
Well, it's ingrained in about 16 countries, my country among them. But then as a midwife, I went home to my country, Somaliland, in 1960-61. And for the first time in my life, I was delivering women whose baby had to be born through a passage that had been so damaged and so changed, which was not the case when I was delivering babies in England. And it brought back the pain and the revolt I felt against this practice, which has no place in Islam. It's totally against the teachings of Islam. So I started talking about it, but then very few people would listen to us. They would think it was rude and impolite and shameful to be talking about reproductive parts of the woman's body. But then there comes a time in life when you have to call a spade a spade. And I picked up the microphone and spoke against it in public. Everybody was angry that I, as the daughter of Dr. So-and-so and the former wife of the first president of Somaliland after independence, could pick up a microphone and speak about it. But somebody had to.
What do you remember about the day that it happened to you?
Pain. Pain that I have never known the same since. My mother's friends, my grandmother was there. There was a big fat sheep there waiting to be slaughtered because they were going to have a feast because the doctor's daughter had been purified. And they just grab you, tie you down, grab your legs, and an old woman reaches between your legs and with a knife cuts away. No anesthesia. You bleed, you scream, you faint. And the wound is sutured together, not with needle and thread, but with acacia thorns and tied together. So when my father came home at night and found that this had been done to me, this was the first time I saw tears in his eyes. And seeing the anger of my father and how he was angry at his own mother and at my mother, his wife, that gave me the message that what had been done to me was wrong.
Apart from the appalling physical injury that it must surely have taken, well, years to recover from, how did it affect you?
One never recovers from it.
Right.
The wounds heal, but your rebellion against it, the emotional pain, never goes. And it just makes you want to do something about it. And I hope that by bringing it out to the world, that there is a voice now and the world is listening to it and realizing that it should not be done to women.
Let's have your next piece of music, Edna Adan. What are we going to
do? Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening by Robert Frost.
And why have you chosen this poem?
I'm a midwife. I have miles to go before I sleep because there are things that need to be done.
Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near between the woods and frozen lake the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds, the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep.
That was Robert Frost reading his own poem, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. So, Edna Adan, when you came to Britain in the mid-50s to take up that nursing scholarship, it was hardly a place where women were treated equally to men, but I'm guessing it must have felt much freer than your life had been as a young female in Somaliland. What sort of things did you do here that you couldn't have done at home?
I went to the Barrow Polytechnic, by the way, now the University of the South Bank, but a college where boys and girls study together. We played sports together, we were in the same courses together, we rode the same buses, so I was just a person like every other student.
And did you learn to drive here as well?
I learned to drive, yes, and I loved driving.
And were you allowed to drive when you went back to Somaliland?
Oh no, that was a big... It took them 6 months to accept me to drive, and then they would go to my father and say, Dr. Adan, we saw your daughter driving your car again, don't let her. And why not? But she's a girl. And he said, well, do you think I do not know that my daughter is a girl? And it took them 6 months, and I refused to give up and continued and eventually became the first female to get a driving license. And I continue ever since. And by the way, I took part in a rally once when it was required that it would be a driver and a female companion. So my brother's wife became my companion, both wearing trousers and caps.
How did you get on?
I was the fifth car, and I should have been given a reward or a trophy. But because I was impersonating a man, I was fined.
That'll teach
and,
you.
And, I was not impersonating anybody. A driver is a driver.
It was 7 years you were in the UK.
I was 7 years here.
Now, this was a time of explicit, casual, ingrained racism in the UK. Did you meet any of that?
Very often I would be the only black face in the class, but I made friends with everybody. I loved what I was doing. I was a very passionate student. And in fact, I had a lot of Scottish friends, and I used to be called Edna MacIshmael. And when I had Irish friends, I would be Edna O'Ismael.
And you actually worked as a midwife?
I worked as a midwife. I was trained at the Hammersmith Hospital and Lewisham Hospital. I rode my bicycle. I delivered women in their homes.
You rode your bicycle a la called the midwife, did you?
Yes, of course. Yes, of course. We had a black raincoat and our caps and our black bag, and we would go to address so-and-so and deliver a woman. And loved it.
Time for more music, Edna Adan. Tell me what we're going to hear now. We're on your fifth.
My fifth is Frank Sinatra, another favourite singer that I have. And his song is My Way. And it describes so much my life also.
And now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. My friend, I'll say it clear, I'll state my case, of which I'm certain I've lived.
That was Frank Sinatra and My Way. So, Edna Adan, your first husband, Mohammed Eagle, was a Somali politician, but you'd actually met him in London when you were students, and back then you dated briefly, but it was a good number of years later that you... It was sort of out of the blue. You received this proposal. What actually happened?
I first met him when I first came to the UK in 1954. He was one of the many Somali young men who were studying here. Mohammed Ibrahim was born to one of the richest men in my country. So for him, you know, sending beautiful flowers and picking me up in his red convertible MG.
How glamorous.
Yes. Curtains would be, you know, flickering to look at this little Somali girl and this Somali man in this convertible red MG. And then he disappeared. Never heard from him for a long time, didn't know what happened to him. But it seems that his father had a stroke, so he had to rush back. I forgot to write. And until one day he asked for my hand. And I was so angry. I thought, well, my goodness, an educated man, he should get to know me first and he should ask me whether I want to marry him or not. Being a rich man doesn't buy my emotions.
So he asked your father?
He asked my father, which was the right thing in the culture to do.
Yes.
But I rebelled against it. I said, you should have asked me first. Anyway, when we married, he was the leader of the opposition.
Right. So he did. He became prime minister in 1967?
He was elected prime minister of the United Somalia then, Somaliland and Somalia United.
I've seen many, all of them, very glamorous photographs of you meeting presidents and dignitaries in lots of very fabulous frocks and jewellery. I mean, you met people like Charles de Gaulle and President Lyndon Johnson.
Prime Minister Harry Wilson.
Yes.
I enjoyed it. I loved it.
When did you fit in the nursing shifts as well? Because that's what I've read.
I was a nurse before I was married, so my husband had to understand that. And the arrangement was that 2 days a week, I would still continue to go and teach my students and deliver babies in the maternity ward and wear a uniform. So even though I'm the wife of the prime minister, when I go home or before I came to work this morning, but when I'm with a patient, I treat her with respect, with kindness, with affection.
And how were you treated by the people working around you at that point?
They were shocked. They thought, well, this is not good for the prime minister. And how could the prime minister allow his wife to go to work? But after a while, people became to accept that and accepted it. And they saw the work that I was doing.
In 1969, there was a military coup and the president, not the prime minister, but the president...
was shot.
Was assassinated. You were put under house arrest for a number...
for 6 months.
...of months. How did you escape house arrest?
A hotel caught fire and there were announcements on the radio that all health, anybody trained in healthcare, was required to come to the hospital to take care of the wounded. So I walked out of the house. The guards had not been given the instructions to shoot me and they didn't know what to do. And I said, look, I'm going to the hospital. There are wounded. I will help there and I will come back. You come with me and come back with me if you wish, or wait for me here because I will come back. And I walked to the hospital, worked all night, and the next morning walked back home and there were no guards. And they never came back again.
Tell me about your sixth choice of the morning, Edna Adan.
My sixth choice, of course, is Ella Fitzgerald, my favourite singer. I love Ella Fitzgerald. She's seen me through so many things. But on this particular occasion, I choose it because when my husband was in jail with all his cabinet and all the members of parliament, and we were not allowed to communicate with them or visit them, and when I came out of my house arrest 6 months later, I would take my car and... this is one of our favourite songs, and would play it full volume, take out the button that controls the volume of the car.
And you were sitting outside the prison doing this?
Yeah, just outside the prison, and arrange to have a punctured tyre or just release the air out of my tyre so I cannot move. And the police, traffic police, would come and say, well, turn this noise down. I say, I cannot, it has no button. They say, well, move, I cannot, I have a punctured tyre. So they would try and help me change my attire. But in the meantime, my song would be heard. And twice I did that. And my husband confirmed to me that he did hear it on both occasions.
A cigarette that bears a lipstick's traces, an airline ticket to romantic places, and still my heart has wings. These foolish things remind me of you.
These foolish things, sung there by Ella Fitzgerald. So, Edna Adan, by the late 70s, you were living in Oman.
I loved my time in Oman. We spent 6 years. The only problem was that I couldn't work. As the wife of the ambassador, I was not allowed to do paid or unpaid work.
And this was your second husband?
It was my third husband.
It was your third. I'm sorry, I missed one out. I don't know how I managed that.
That's okay. That's okay. It's my third and last husband. And so I just continued to do consultancies for the UN because I need to work. I started training nurses and midwives in Djibouti when I was the wife of the ambassador in Oman.
And you say this was your third and last marriage. What sort of wife have you made over the years?
I was not the ideal Somali wife. I think. I work. I voice my opinion. I have a brain. I try to use it. I'm a hopeless cook. I did not bear children.
Was there a time when you wanted to have children? Or did it never really...
Oh, all the time. I think every hormone ever invented was tried on me. Every
right.
obstetrician. But it just didn't happen. And maybe it was a good thing that it did not, because at the end of the day, if I had children, I would not have spent so much time and resources and energy on my hospital today. And when I was praying for just one or two children, I think God had 4 million and more for me. And today, every child is my child. You know, I devote whatever time and energy I have on my patients.
And you say you think now around about 22,000 babies have been born in your hospital.
Yes.
Tell me for a minute about... I had read, I don't know if it's true, that at the point where you were trying to fund the hospital and get its building off the ground, you sold not just your fine jewellery and not just your beloved Mercedes, but you also even sold your dishwasher. Is that true?
Well, of course, a dishwasher and a microwave and washing machine and electric cooker. What are these going to do for me in Somaliland where I had no electricity, where I have no running water? I had gifts of jewellery. I never wore them. They were always in a safety box. They were always a burden. I had to insure them. I had to lock them up. Today, I'm free. I'm liberated. And I use my jewellery every day because I spent that money to put in the toilets and the wash taps and the wash basins. So I use my jewellery several times a day, and so do several hundred people in the hospital.
And you use your World Health Organization pension
as well?
My pension,
yeah. Yes. While I'm alive, my pension comes. But the day I will die, the hospital has to learn to fend for itself, because although we do have the cost sharing, we still have a lot of expenses that I subsidise and cover.
It had been your dream from the age of 12 years old, and when you were selling your various possessions to try to fund it in the beginning, was there ever a moment when you thought, I don't think this is going to happen, I don't think it's going to become a reality?
Oh, no, I never had any doubts. I knew how to make it work. Whether my resources would ever be sufficient to build the kind of hospital I wanted, that's where the doubt came.
Now tell me, what do you think your father would have made of this hospital?
I think he probably would have approved of it. He would have liked me to have had people to help me, because he would be wiser than I am. I don't know how much longer I'll be able to run the place, and I still don't have somebody who is crazy enough to take over from me. He probably would have told me, delegate, which I'm trying to do now.
Tell me, Edna, about your next piece of music then. What are we going to hear now?
My next piece of music is by Whitney Houston, I Will Always Love You. And I will always love my profession. And I will always love my people. And I will always love Somaliland.
And my darling, you
That was Whitney Houston and I Will Always Love You. And you said during that to me, Edna Adan, that you said, my life has been filled with love. I've had so much love. You were talking about encountering little kids in the streets in Somaliland.
Yes, kids in the streets and villages I've never visited. And then sometimes they see me on TV or they know of me and they, Edna, and wave to me. And were you born in a hospital? And some of them say, yes, we were. And then somebody else says, no, he was not. I was, but he was not. I love it. I've had a wonderful life.
And it has been, of course, as we have learned today, it's been a life pretty much devoted to helping others. And you do play it down because you seem to be somebody brimful of hope, but full of appalling and demanding circumstances often, surely. Have there ever been times when you have felt personally overwhelmed?
Well, there have been occasions when I have been scared and worried and, am I doing the right thing? Did I take on more than I could chew? And then the next emergency happens and we save a life. And I say, yes, now I know why I did it.
What scares you?
Evacuating casualties from a hospital during the war. And the car breaks down in the night. And hyenas smell the infected wounds, try to attack us. And that was very scary. And I think, oh, my God, what am I doing? You know, I only took them from one hospital to take them only to be eaten up by hyenas. That was a very scary moment. Put me in jail.
You spent your 38th birthday in jail.
My 38th birthday, I was in jail. I didn't know what I was in jail for. My husband and I both were arrested. And I said, what did you do? And he said, what did you say?
What did they tell you you were in jail for?
We were supposedly plotting to escape from the country. But I spent 9 days of my life in jail for that.
Let's talk for a moment about being, you know, you're here to be cast away to this island.
Yes,
that's
yes,
what's going to happen next. You have clearly proved that you can live pretty much without creature comforts. When you are cast away on this island, when there is no to-do list, when people are not knocking at the tiny door of your room and saying, Edna, come and help us with this, that and the next thing, when you are all alone without your beloved hospital and all your colleagues, how will it suit you?
That will kill me. You know, I love being needed. I love to be able to help. I love to have something to wake up for in the morning, something to do. I've got to have a challenge. You know, I always say that I was always born with this sort of desire to fix it. And if I have nothing to fix, then I wouldn't know how to deal with my life.
You've recently celebrated your 80th birthday. What are your plans for the future?
I continue to work for as long as I can, for as long as it's safe for me to work, for my patients. And I hope to die with my proverbial boots on. And if I can contribute to women's education, to fighting harmful practices, don't think of yourself as, I'm just a girl, what can I do? And I was a girl once and look what I've done. Get up and go and do it.
Tell me about your final piece of music then. What are we going to hear?
My final piece of music will be This Is My Island in the Sun by Harry Belafonte. I love Harry Belafonte.
Oh, island in the sun, will to me by my father's hand, all my days I will sing in praise of your forest waters, your shining sand. As morning breaks.
That was Harry Belafonte and Island in the Sun. And you mentioned during that, Edna, that you queued up outside the Hammersmith Palace. You think it was 1957 or 58?
Yeah, 57, 58.
To get tickets to see him.
Oh, my goodness, what a great singer.
It's time now for me to give you the books. You get the Bible, or would you prefer the Quran?
I prefer the Quran.
So the Quran and the complete works of Shakespeare. And you get to take one other book along with you. What will your book
be? Oh, that book would have to be Half the Sky by Nicholas Kristof. It has a chapter about my hospital as well. And I haven't had time to read all the other chapters.
We shall give you that book then that you asked for. You're allowed to have a luxury. What's your luxury going to be?
Well, I would have loved to have had a pet, but you won't allow me that.
No, we won't.
So give me some seeds, vegetables and beans and tomatoes and peppers to grow. Something living to take care of.
I can certainly do that. You're allowed one track to save. If the waves were to threaten to wash away these discs, which one would you save?
Oh, I Will Always Love You.
It's yours.
I Will Always Love My Country.
Edna Adan Ismail, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this edition of Desert Island Discs. You'll find more interviews with comedians, artists, musicians, scientists, sports stars and more at bbc.co.uk/Desert Island Discs.
This is the BBC.